We can at least take you on this next journey with no risk at all. You can stay at home as we go to one of the oldest cities in the world, Aleppo in northern Syria. It has prided itself on its food for 1,000 years or more, and now it's a destination for adventurous food tourists, as well as for NPR's Deborah Amos.
The romance begins at the outdoor food market. Radishes as big as apples, fresh white cheese bobbing in milky water, shiny olives, hundreds of pickles, and thick pomegranate molasses. Then there's the spice markets, with yellow turmeric, pink rose petals, and red sun-dried pepper pastes. This city, surrounded by olive, nut, and fruit orchards, is famous for a love of eating. The cuisine, a product of fertile land and location, along the Silk Road, an ancient trading route.
Thanks to this melting pot of caravans, which took place in Aleppo especially, all kinds of produce, fresh and preserved, used to pass by Aleppo.
That's Pierre Antaki, head of the Syrian Academy of Gastronomy. The International Academy in France awarded Aleppo its culinary prize a few years ago. Thanks, but Aleppo was a food capital long before Paris. Aleppo's diverse communities, Arabs, Kurds, Armenians, Circassians, a sizable Christian population, all contributed food traditions since Aleppo was part of the Ottoman Empire, says Antaki.
The Sultan of Istanbul would send his chef to Aleppo to spy, to see what the caravans are bringing, what's new that he doesn't know.
The Turks are here again, this time as tourists. Turkey and Syria lifted visa restrictions in September. There's been a flood of cross-border trade. Restaurant owners now speak some Turkish and English for Western tourists who come on gourmet tours. But the test of any city's food culture is in the small traditional shops. This one, known as Abu Abdo, specializes in ful, a typical breakfast meal, fava bean soup with a splash of olive oil, lemon juice, and Aleppo's red peppers. A family business owned for more than 70 years, the owner ladles the ful into plastic bags for the to-go crowd, workers as well as businessmen, because it's the best in town.
Abu Abdo, the name. Now it becomes a kind of trademark for the ful in Aleppo.
Samir Akkad, a native of the city, says the food culture is easy to explain.
In Aleppo, we like our stomach. We like good food, rich of fat and, you know, kibbeh.
Kibbeh? Anybody who's ever eaten in the Middle East knows kibbeh, a deep-fried oval of cracked wheat with ground meat inside, often greasy and tasteless. In the hands of Aleppo's chefs, kibbeh is an art form, and the artists are finally being rewarded. Syria is opening up its economy after decades of state control, which has revived restaurants and created stars in the kitchen, says Pierre Antaki.
The demand was high. The promotion was fast. A chef today gets 10, 15 folds what a chef would get 10 years ago.
On most nights, serious eaters gather here, in a dining hall above a hotel. This is a private food club with 600 local members. Their prosperity is on display on the coat rack, mostly mink. This club is known for bridge games, birthday celebrations, and a long menu.
Here, our food is very, very good, and always it's the best in town.
Lucienne Saloum says she misses the food whenever she's away from home.
It's made of very different ingredients. We are using everything that we can find. Yes, very complex.
This treasured cuisine is opening Syria to more extensive tourism, says Antaki.
Slowly, slowly, we have had groups of people coming just to taste the food and see some stones, but their main purpose was to enjoy some good meals.
And when it comes to opening the economy and the country, it turns out that food is a better draw than ancient history.
I'm making a story about Aleppo food. I'm going to eat this tonight.
Aleppo food is great.
Deborah Amos, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Raw food and molecular gastronomy, low-carb diets, and celebrity chefs, just a few of the food fads that were on the menu over the last decade. But come on, what did we really eat in the past 10 years? Not just read about, but actually put on our plates and into our stomachs. For real answers about America's real dietary trends, we turn to Harry Balzer. He's vice president with the NPD Group. That's a consumer marketing research firm. And he specializes in studying what Americans eat, and that's why we're talking to him. Welcome to the program, and Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, Michelle.
So, was there one specific thing that defined the American diet over the last decade?
Well, if there is one that defines this decade, it would have to be yogurt.
Yogurt?
Yogurt would be the category or the food that has increased in our dietary habits more than any other food during the past 10 years.
Color me surprised.
And it probably, if you think about your own behavior, I'll bet you start your day off a lot with yogurt or have it during lunchtime or maybe have it as a dessert or a side dish or as a snack, more than you did probably 10 years ago.
That's true.
It's one of those things that kind of sneaks up on you, but yeah, I think defines what America's really looking for from its food supply.
Well, now, is it because yogurt is something that's healthy or because it's convenient or because it now comes in all kinds of forms? It's not just in tubs, it's in tubes, it's frozen, it's...
Say yes to all of those. It's very convenient. It's very individualized. You don't get a bunch of yogurt like you get a pizza pie and celebrate with everybody else. This is just for you. It's your own flavor. It has a health halo certainly surrounding it. It really does define what I think America wants from its food supply.
So beyond yogurt, what other shifts have we seen? Are there foods that have surged and others that have disappeared or all but faded away from the menu?
Well, the item that has faded away, and I won't say it's disappeared, it's just not as popular, would be toast. But on the flip side of that, we've been eating more breakfast sandwiches, particularly in our car. Matter of fact, that would probably be one of the other trends that have gone on in this country is the use of drive-through to feed ourselves more and more.
In the morning?
Well, throughout the day, to be honest with you, at lunchtime and the pickup and bringing home from restaurants. That's been a moving trend throughout this decade. Although the one trend that I would say is another one that defined the decade that was unlike the previous five decades, going back to World War II, was the stopping of us using restaurants more. We went for nearly five decades of every decade we could count that Americans would buy more meals at a restaurant at the end of the decade than at the beginning of the decade. But this will be the first decade in my lifetime where this has not occurred.
We have been talking about food, but what about beverages? Was there a drink of the decade?
Oh, the drink of the decade, without a question, and probably identifies what America is or was, is bottled water.
I thought you were going to say coffee.
It's a funny thing. The peak year for coffee consumption in this country was 1946. It's really not been increasing since 1946. Mm. It's been declining, if anything. But what has happened is we've shifted where we get that coffee. The first shift was getting more of it away from home and less likely to have it in home. No, actually, the very first shift was not to end up having coffee at lunch or dinner. There was a time during the 50s and 60s where this country ended its meals with coffee. It's today you just have it at breakfast time.
So you say, though, that the actual beverage of the decade was bottled water. Take me back to the beginning of this decade, the year 2000.
And again, this is probably something that's been going on for more than that, than just this decade, but it is by far the fastest growing beverage. And it was a category that also kind of surprised us. It's certainly not new. We know water. You can only walk away saying the only advantage it must have had was it was convenient. It was convenient to have a beverage always near you that didn't require any other special handling. It didn't have to be hot. It didn't have to be ice cold. It just had to be a liquid. As the decade would progress, we'd find that people found ways of flavoring this thing, making it healthier, adding things to it, so that it really became kind of like what carbonated beverages were to begin with, and that's really the beverage it replaced.
Mr. Balzer, it's New Year's Day, so this is a good opportunity for us to look ahead and perhaps look into your crystal ball and talk a little bit about the trends of the future. What's the next decade hold?
Well, the next decade is much more, it's going to be very difficult to predict, but I will tell you if we talk 10 years from now, we will talk about those things that made our lives easier. That will be the driving force, because that is the long-term trend in eating is who's going to find the new way of preparing the meal for us? Who's going to find the easier way to deliver the food to us? Who's going to find the easier way to clean up the food for us? What won't change is what we eat. I will tell you, the number one food that we will eat in the year 2020 will be a ham sandwich. And I know that because I've been doing this for 30 years, and I was hard-pressed in 1980 to be asked, what will we be eating in 1990, when I discovered that the ham sandwich was the number one thing we ate in 1980, and I made a prediction that we'd be eating in 1990, and guess what we ate in 1990? A ham sandwich. What do you think it was 2000? A ham sandwich. 2010? a ham sandwich. So do I have to go out on a limb to tell you that the number one food we'll be eating in this country in the year 2020 will be a ham sandwich? What I don't know is what will be the bread. There'll be something new about the ingredients or the condiments that go on this. But when I ask you, what did you have, you'll say, oh, I had a ham sandwich.
Harry Balzer, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I think there's a ham sandwich in my future, so I'm going to let you go. Harry Balzer is a vice president with the consumer marketing research firm, the NPD Group. Thanks so much for talking to us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
The nation's economic woes have been particularly hard on the dairy industry. Milk prices are at historic lows, and many dairy farmers are going bankrupt. Still, some farmers have found a way to survive. They've gone organic. NPR's Kathleen Masterson visited an organic family farm in northern Vermont.
At this hour, well before dawn, the only light around is coming from the barn. Tim McShillo and his teenage son, Max, are milking the herd, hooking each cow up to a pump, which sends the milk to a central stainless steel tank. The barn smells like cow breath and hay. Tim's wife, Kristen Dellert, is bottle feeding the 9 baby cows, including the one born in the pasture a few hours ago.
We're milking about 42 right now. It takes me about an hour and a half to milk.
For 3 years now, Tim and Kristen have been running an organic farm. That means the cows have to get feed grown without pesticides. They can't have antibiotics or growth hormones either. And for at least 3 months a year, the cows have to be out on pasture.
I drive out there and I'll sit and have my coffee and call them and they'll slowly get up. I'll have to get out and roust a few up and then they slowly make their way to the barn. Hello, Sassy. Hello, Sassy. Ooh.
The gingerbread's on there. It's all Christmas special.
A family home is tucked amid the low green hills of Coventry, Vermont. From the breakfast table, they can see the cows grazing out back. This farm is making it now, but it wasn't always. A few years ago, Tim and Kristen tried running a conventional dairy.
Well, actually, we moved up here from Connecticut because Tim wanted to be a dairy farmer. And as a speech pathologist, I could work just about anywhere.
That was in 2000. Right away, Kristen says, they realized it was going to be a lot of work, hands-on work.
The first time I went into the barn and Tim says to me, that cow's in labor over there, you need to check her. No, put a glove on and make sure the nose and feet are coming out. And I'm like, I have a master's degree.
Kristen learned how to birth a baby cow and many other dairy chores. Through it all, she kept her full-time day job. But still, they weren't making enough to live on.
Tim said, you know, we're working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we don't get to set the price for our product. He said, this is crazy. So we sold the cows, and Tim did his own construction business for a while, excavating business. I kept working.
But after a couple of years with an empty barn, they decided to try again. This time, they would go organic. One reason was the money. These days, conventional farmers are actually getting paid less for their milk than it costs them to produce it.
They're losing their shirts, basically, just to stay in the business.
Meanwhile, organic farmers are selling their milk for a slim profit. They're getting about a dollar more per gallon than conventional. So you might think all conventional farms would be going organic right now. But Kristen and Tim say it's not for everybody. For one thing, you have to know your cows pretty well. Their son Max can name every cow, even from across the pasture.
And then we have Bean, who's Coffee's baby, and then Glaze, who was Donut's baby.
And Lisa Marie, who's Presley's baby.
If a cow is getting sick, they know right away. That's important, because organic farmers can't give their animals antibiotics. It's a lot of work, and it's expensive. The organic feed costs more, and so do the organic remedies for sick cows. But Kristen says it's worth it.
We actually think they're healthier because we find they're under less stress because they get to go out. Cows love being out on pasture. They're meant to eat grass. Right. So anything else that you give them puts them under stress.
Tim and Kristen have had a lot of help learning how to run an organic farm. They're part of a co-op called Organic Valley. It helps by marketing and distributing the milk. Kristen says being part of a co-op allows each farm to be more than just a milk factory.
Because it truly does give farmers an alternative in terms of how they're treated and what's being done with our milk.
Still, In today's economy, even organic farmers are feeling the pinch. Tim and Kristen's dairy is making just enough for both of them to be full-time farmers, but they've had to make some cutbacks.
We've let our hired help go because we have to reduce our costs. So now it's just the three of us.
They've had to postpone plans to expand, but still Tim and Kristen feel lucky their dairy is in the black, and they trust the organic movement will weather the economic downturn. Kathleen Masterson, NPR News.